This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at how Occupy Wall Street parody papers have sparked legal action from bigger newspapers.
The great and powerful Chicago Tribune was irritated by the Occupy Chicago Tribune and thought, but not for long, that it could swat them down.
Recently, a black site in Romania was uncovered by a media group from Germany.
There are more Guantanamos out there, as reporter John Getz will tell us.
Author Joe Allen joins us today to talk about the first use of the Smith Act in 1943.
That law is still on the books. It was used to roll back the radicalization of the labor movement, starting in the 30s, and really bring it to a halt up till today. It's an important law. We should learn more about it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
It's interesting, instructive, and really amusing to follow Newt Gingrich in his challenge to Mitt Romney. Gingrich, infused by $5 million from his billionaire friend, casino owner Adelson, infused with this $5 million, Gingrich is now calling Mitt Romney a vulture capitalist. Why? Well, Romney was the founder and head of a leveraged buyout organization called Bain Capital. What does a leveraged buyout organization do? Well, it got off the ground in the 80s. They would go out, raise money, they would borrow money, then they would buy capitalist firms that they thought were a little shaky. And they would take those firms and they would reorganize them. They would streamline them. Very often they would fire a lot of people. And then they would sell the now streamlined firm, pay back people who lent them the money to begin with very handsomely, and all the time profiting because they had the tax laws fixed so that the income they made from this kind of operation was taxed at a much lower level. Well, any stick'll do to beat a dog, I guess Gingrich figured, or maybe he thought, although I doubt it, of Lenin's famous quip that one capitalist would sell the rope to another capitalist, which he could use to hang himself. But in any case, Gingrich thought of the idea of getting money from his longtime friend and supporter, Adelson, the casino operator, this billionaire, and taking the money and putting it in a super political action committee, a super PAC. Super PACs are now legal under the Citizens United decision, as long as they're not controlled directly by a candidate. And in this case, the super PAC is controlled by friends of Gingrich. The super PAC bought a movie about Mitt Romney and his days as a leveraged buyout specialist as head of Bain Capital. And they're using segments of this movie in the Gingrich campaign against Romney. So the interesting thing is that capitalism generally is a system to make profit. That's the reason for a capitalist organization to exist. They buy things cheap and sell them dear. They like to get low rent. They like to buy raw materials inexpensively. And they like to get labor as cheap as possible. Labor is a commodity, just like a raw material. The notion of vulture capitalists is kind of redundant. All capitalists, in a sense, are vultures because they're trying to make a profit off of other people's labor. But the leveraged buyout organizations were particularly egregious. The famous book and movie, Barbarians at the Gate, exemplified one of these outfits when they took over the Nabisco Corporation. Another example of leveraged buyout is when General Mills, which is a Minneapolis, Minnesota headquartered company that sells grains, including breakfast cereals, General Mills bought the newspaper Newsday. There was a Long Island Newsday edition, and then for a short period of time, there was a New York City Newsday edition. It was the most liberal, quite a really good paper in New York City. Well, General Mills bought the newspaper, and then they closed it down. So people who were working at the newspaper said, "How can you do that to us? We were making 5% a year for you." General Mills said, yeah, but that wasn't enough. So they became known as the serial killer. In any case, the leveraged buyout activity of the 80s is still going on. The leveraged buyout companies support not just the Republican Party, but the Democratic Party. Blackstone, which is the famous and largest leveraged buyout company, is a big contributor to the Democratic Party. Why? Because it takes both parties to keep that tax rate down low. When you see on TV Gingrich's ads against Mitt Romney for being a predator, a vulture capitalist, remember one thing. Gingrich is on the board of directors of another vulture capitalist law firm. And if you want a definition of opportunism, this is it. The Occupied Wall Street Journal here in New York City inspired the Occupied Chicago Tribune out in the Midwest. Recently, attorneys for the Chicago Tribune have accused the publishers of the Occupied Chicago Tribune of trademark infringement. We're joined today by Chicago attorney Michael Deutsch, a partner at the People's Law Office, who's been involved with this issue in Chicago. Michael Deutsch, you're an attorney, a partner at the People's Law Office. I remember you from the old days when you were the legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. You're still causing trouble out in Chicago, and I understand you're representing some of the people who are publishing the Occupied Chicago Tribune. What's the beef?
Well, the Chicago Tribune contacted some of those people and threatened to shut down their website and their Facebook page and to go into federal court and sue them for trademark infringement because they said the word Chicago Tribune is a trademark that belongs solely to the Chicago Tribune and no one else can use it for any purpose or in any way. And they had this big-time trademark law firm that was threatening these young people who had published the Occupied Chicago Tribune. Through you, actually, we were contacted, and we looked at the thing and said, wow, this is not right. And even if they do sue them, I think that the publicity will be negative to the Chicago Tribune and positive to the occupied people.
I called you only after I first spoke with our friend and colleague, Peter Weiss, who's now retired, but for many years a prominent trademark lawyer here in New York City, and who was on the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights when you were there, and still is on the board with me. And I also spoke with your partner, Ben Elson, my nephew, who did some of the research on this. So when you came on board, I thought, well, you know, this isn't going to be an even fight anymore. I think that maybe we're on top. I mean, what are the legal issues here? How can the Chicago Tribune object to somebody parodying their name? Here, this pillar of the media. What possible grounds do they have to stand on?
Well, I mean, there is what's called the Lanham Trademark Act, which protects trademarks from people, you know, expropriating them. And there's also this Dilution Act, which prevents people from using or diluting their trademark by using it in some unnecessary or, you know, dismissive way. But the reality is, and this was never, what happened was when the people from Occupied were first contacted, they were very fearful because they were fearful of being sued by the Chicago Tribune and maybe damages against them. And they contacted a local lawyer here and basically told that local lawyer, well, we don't want to have to go to court, just figure out a way to get out of it. And the local lawyer then contacted this lawyer for this the Tribune and said, well, we're willing to change our name and we're willing to do this or that. They even agreed at some point to change their name to the Occupied Chicago Times. And the Tribune, this is before we got involved, but the Tribune turned that down and said you can't use any name that talks about the Tribune or the Times or anything that refers to a newspaper.
That's the tyranny of intellectual property law.
Yeah. And they were just really aggressive and pushing and saying, if we don't hear from you in 48 hours, we're going to order your Facebook shutdown and your website. So with Peter's help, actually, because we consulted with him extensively, we realize that this is a classic parody case because, in fact, they're saying we're the media of the 99% and the Tribune is the media of the 1%. By using the Occupied Chicago Tribune, they're parroting or they're criticizing or they're commenting, and that's basic First Amendment rights. Now, the law is kind of interestingly not that clear on it, but what most courts do is they balance whether there's going to be confusion by the use of the name against the First Amendment rights, and it's kind of a balancing test. But how can anyone be confused when they see something that says Occupied Chicago Tribune, the media for the 99%, and in their masthead they're now saying we are not affiliated with the Chicago Tribune Corporation, which is the media for the 1%. We made it clear, we made those changes, they agreed to them, we put them on the masthead, and then when we went back to the lawyer, he flipped out, and we had told him that if he went to court, we thought there was they were doing it in bad faith to chill the First Amendment rights of the occupied people, and we thought there could be a Rule 11 claim here. And
well, explain what the Rule 11 sanctions are.
Yeah, Rule 11 is if you bring a case in bad faith, then there's a rule which says you can get damages against the party if there's no good faith claim that you're bringing. And we're saying there's no possibility for confusion here. And given the First Amendment rights of the occupied people, any balancing test which, given there's no possibility of confusion, would come out in favor of the occupiers. In addition, the dilution law specifically excludes people who are acting by parody or criticism or comment. So the law has pretty much accepted and recognized that there's a First Amendment right at play here. And then we told them, look, I don't understand why the Tribune would want to run into court here, because you're going to get a lot of bad publicity and negative attention to your newspaper by doing this. You're going to be seen as bullies, as arrogant, and is, you know, trying to stop First Amendment activity. Interestingly, and I don't know if it's over yet, but by the last week they were threatening to go to court immediately and threatening to shut down their Facebook. And after we sent them that email and told them what our position was, we haven't heard anything from them. The website's still up, Facebook's still up, they haven't gone to court. So maybe they realize that for us it's a win-win situation. If they go to court, we're going to win on the legal grounds, plus we're going to get a lot of positive publicity. So maybe they've thought better of it. I don't know yet, you know, but it seems to me if they were hot to go to court last week, and this week we've heard nothing from them.
Well, Michael Deutsch, you really turned the tables on the fearsome Chicago Tribune. I think it's absolutely wonderful. Arun Gupta, who started the Occupied Wall Street Journal here in New York and who's now touring the country writing a book for Haymarket on the Occupied movement in various cities around the country, first alerted me to this situation. And then I heard from Arun the other day saying that the Oakland Tribune is still hot to do something against the Occupy people in Oakland. And in Tampa, Florida, the same problem obtains. So I'm hoping that the lesson you've taught the Chicago Tribune lawyers, they're only stepping on their you-know-what. That lesson spreads from coast to coast. What are your final thoughts on this situation, Michael?
Well, I think that any occupied group that's being attacked by the establishment media for parroting the newspapers should fight it, and they shouldn't give in. And any way you look at it, it's going to be a win for good publicity against arrogant media that's trying to shut down people who are critical of them. So I urge people to fight back and not give in, and don't worry about the consequences.
Well, Attorney Michael Deutsch of the People's Law Office in Chicago, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Okay, Michael, take care.
You too.
For many years on this program, we've tried to bring your attention to CIA-run black sites throughout the world. Black sites were secret prisons where all kinds of torture went on, including waterboarding. Today, we bring you an especially interesting story in this continuing effort to ferret out the black sites, hold the CIA responsible, and get the news out. Two remarkable journalists, one from Ard Panorama News Magazine in Germany, and the other from Associated Press, have brought us news about another black site in Europe. We've known about the ones before in Poland and in Lithuania, but this is the first news we have of one in Bucharest, Romania. And what's surprising and shocking about the story is that the site was located right in public view in a downtown office building, a secure office building, but one that you could actually get into, or certainly officials could get into. And underneath that office or offices were six CIA cells in a secret site. It's another remarkable story about the CIA's prisons all over the world. Hopefully, those at least have now come to an end, but there are others still located, other secret prisons or other prisons where we don't know what's going on in Bagram and other places. Here to talk about this remarkable story is John Goetz of Ard Panorama. John Goetz, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Yes, thank you.
So, John, we've covered your stories and work for a number of years in Germany when you were with Der Spiegel, and now, of course, with Ard Panorama, the TV station in Germany. But you've done a lot on secret sites, government surveillance, etc. And your recent article that you did with AP was on a secret site in Bucharest, Romania. And it sort of came for me out of the blue because in some way people have forgotten about secret sites, not much is going on. But why don't you tell us what you discovered in Romania?
Well, the prison that we're talking about was a prison used by the CIA in 2004 and 2005 that only held about six prisoners. We managed to find it based on descriptions from people who had worked there. And then we showed them photos after we came back, and they positively identified it.
When we talk about the prison, where was it in Romania, and what prisoners were held there, and what kind of things went on?
Well, I mean, here's the interesting thing, is that the CIA secret prison was held in a Romanian government organization, which gets called either ORNIS or NSA. And it's basically the Romanian organization used to get Romania up to speed on NATO classification rules. And so it's a building that has a big NATO flag on top of it, and NATO actually even has secret or kind of meetings of intelligence officers there from the different NATO members. We weren't able to figure out if there was actually a meeting that happened while the prisoners were there. But it's a fairly large building, and in kind of the back section in the basement is where the secret prison was located. We went into the ORNIS building in Bucharest, you know, and asked, you know, if they knew about this. They denied that there had been a prison there. They also, though, made it very clear that it was the most secure building in all of Romania.
So in other words, you could walk through the front door of this, I think it's a brick prison in the picture that you put up. You could walk into the front door in downtown Bucharest, ORNIS, and ask about it, and yet the prison, not then apparently, but prior to that, was six cells underground. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that there's kind of a front building which has some public access. I mean, it's against the law to photograph there. You're not, if you walk on the street, you're stopped by police. I mean, it's very, we had to get permission to go to talk to them. And then in this kind of back area where there's kind of an additional entrance, is in the basement of that back area, that is where the secret prison was. So I went into the front building, which is then, of course, connected to the other stuff, and had an appointment to talk to them. Of course, then confronted them on the issue of the secret prison. There was also kind of a security general present in the room who tried to stop the interview at that point, saying, you know, absurd, absurd. But that's what happened.
The description of the prison, I think in your article you said something about six cells. The names of some of the actual people who were there, and were they there initially or did they get transferred from somewhere else?
From what we understand is that for sure al-Nashiri was there. Bin al-Sheb apparently was there.
You should tell us who those people are who they're accused of.
Al-Nashiri is accused of having participated in or helped organize the attack on the USS Cole, Ramzi bin al-Sheb, of course, was one of the initial high-value detainees who was captured in, I think, in March 2002, was seen as one of the organizers of the 9/11 attacks. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was also seen as one of the masterminds of the 9/11 attacks. They were apparently, again, this is, we're not exactly sure about this, they were apparently in the prison after they were made to leave Guantanamo. It's interesting because when the prison shut in Poland in 2003, some of the prisoners were brought to Guantanamo, to a kind of a secret facility within Guantanamo. Even within the secrecy of Guantanamo, there was apparently a facility called Strawberry Fields, referring to Strawberry Fields Forever, where prisoners were kept. And then, according to an AP article, and according to my colleagues from the AP who had researched this, they were worried about a habeas, Supreme Court habeas decision that was coming down. And the prisoners were then removed from the Strawberry Fields prison, some of them brought to Morocco, some of them brought to Bucharest, and some of them to other places. What I understand is that in Poland, Bush came over, if you remember, right after the beginning of the Iraq War, when they didn't find weapons of mass destruction. He was there in May, the end of May and early June 2003. And Poland participated in the Iraq War, and Bush personally went over there to thank Kwasniewski, the president of Poland at the time, and apparently made some gesture to Kwasniewski. This has been reported in the Polish press. I really want to thank you for all your help you've been doing with the prisons. And Kwasniewski then afterwards said, what was he thanking me for? I knew we had some, we were helping them with something. And then he was finally informed about the details about what had been going on in Poland. And according to Polish press, I'm just repeating what they say in the Polish press, Kwasniewski said, you get them out of here right away.
So the president of Poland supposedly asserts that he didn't actually know that there was a secret CIA torture prison in Poland. Is that right?
He learned new details and ordered the thing shut. And it's interesting because they're on the run. I mean, that's the fascinating thing I find, is that they have to leave Poland. Then they go to Guantanamo, right, in September of 2003, if I have it right. In September of 2003, they go to Guantanamo with these prisoners. They're there, and I believe in June 2004, it was announced that there would be habeas, they would take the habeas case, and there would be oral arguments, I think, in July or something like that. There was some, and they decided to get the prisoners out before the oral arguments would be heard.
Okay, I got it now.
They were on the run, the interesting part.
Right, it is interesting. They fly these guys from somewhere to Poland, the secret CIA site in Poland, and the president of Poland says, get them out of here sometime in 2003. They go to Guantanamo, and then we're winning the right to go to court for the prisoners at Guantanamo. They get nervous, and they got to move them from Guantanamo, and that brings us back, at least with regard to some of them, to Bucharest.
Brings them to Bucharest for the first time, and some of them to Morocco, and apparently some of them to other places. But they had to empty out Guantanamo very fast. They were on the run from the rule of law.
I love it. I just love it, John. I mean, I like to sometimes I think our cases don't do that much. Maybe they don't, because they just checkerboard these guys to different sites. But on the other hand, to have them on the run is not bad. So we're back in Bucharest now, and we have these guys in Bucharest. And, of course, at some of these sites, Poland, for example, so-called high-value detainees were waterboarded. Do we know what kind of interrogation methods were used in Bucharest?
Well, we know that al-Nashiri, in his various times in CIA prisons, that his family members, I believe his mother, was threatened with rape. He was waterboarded. A drill was used on him. He was threatened. There was a mock execution and things like that. And we know, of course, that some of the things happened in Poland. It's not exactly sure if all of those things just happened in Poland, and we're not exactly sure what happened in Bucharest. There was one source who indicated that there was not specifically waterboarding, but didn't exclude other things.
Give me a sense of where were the main sites that we know about in Europe, secret sites?
The sites that are known about are, of course, Poland, Bucharest, and in Vilnius. Those are the... There's a little-known site in Bosnia that was used in the days and weeks right after 9/11, which actually came up in a German parliamentary investigation because a military intelligence officer was asked to go in to see an interrogation that was being done of a German citizen of Egyptian descent. And the room was completely bloody, and the person had been was getting beaten up. And the German officer kind of asked back home, what should I do? And he was told to immediately leave the location and not to return and not to have anything to do with it. And that's actually a case that's not very well known in the United States that was from the very beginning. We're talking about, you know, again, September 2001, October 2001, right from the beginning. That wasn't really, though, what we consider to be the CIA, part of the CIA prison network, but that was a prison in Europe that was being used by the United States where prisoners were mistreated as part of the war on terror.
Now, do you have any knowledge, John, that there's any secret sites operating now, whether by the CIA or the military or any agency of the U.S. government?
You mean secret prisons?
Secret prisons.
I mean, there's a huge, I don't know how secret it is, I mean, there's a huge part of Bagram that is basically, you know, a prison. I mean, there's a huge part of, there's kind of a military prison there, and then there's apparently also a CIA prison. I understand that in Africa there are prisons that are kind of run on a new model whereby the Africans run the prison, or the, you know, the specific states run the prisons there. It's quarterbacked, is the expression that they use, by CIA people who kind of ask questions through others, and sometimes CIA officers themselves, but that's, would we call that a CIA prison? I'm not sure.
Right, I understand, but it is, it has some of the same problems, obviously, of
people. Well, they've learned. I mean, right. You know, that's the, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, it's not a completely American-run facility because it makes it easier to deny. It's one of the things that they've learned.
In the work on this Bucharest prison, in the articles, and I know you spend a lot of time checking flight logs of all these CIA rendition flights, etc., there is some indication that there was a flight from Poland to Bucharest. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, there was one person who worked at the American embassy in Bucharest who apparently was involved in mistreating prisoners in Poland. So that was one of the things that we were always looking for. Were there flights transporting him to Poland and back? But there is also a flight around the time where the prison in Poland closed back to or to Bucharest, and it's unclear if that was a prisoner transport or if that was used to transport people who worked at the prison.
Right. Now, one of the companies that's mentioned in these articles is Richmore Aviation, which is apparently a New York-based charter company.
Yeah, New York State, yeah.
New York State, and it operated certain kinds of flights. Can you talk about that?
What's fascinating about the Richmore Aviation case, and there's actually a number of these things, where their former CIA airlines, or airlines that worked for the CIA, are in kind of fights about money and people getting paid and not getting paid, and so there have been these civil suits, and as part of the civil suits, they produce their receipts. You know, we transported, you know, seven prisoners, or and we didn't get paid enough for this. And that's true with some other airlines that work for the CIA. And it's actually been a great opportunity to look at some of the documents that otherwise would be classified.
Right. So we do have this company that's chartered in New York, at least ran a bunch of flights around the CIA rendition program,
including some cases of prisoner transports. Yes.
Now, you have three countries that are identified in the article, and possibly four if we include Bosnia: Poland, Lithuania, Romania. Of course, Obama administration has not done anything to the CIA who ran these sites or the people who were involved in abuse and interrogation and torture at these sites. But what about the laws in those three countries? Is there any possibility in those three countries of prosecuting various CIA people or others?
Well, right now, there's a very interesting investigation in Poland that's been ongoing for, over 2 years. A lot of evidence has been gathered. In the summertime, the Polish prosecutor who was running the investigation was taken off the case and someone else was put on, and there was a lot of speculation in the Polish press about what that actually meant. So that's actually potentially remains a very interesting case. In Romania, there was an investigation into the secret prison, a parliamentary investigation, where, interestingly enough, the security classification for the members of the Parliamentary Investigative Committee was approved by Ornis, the place where we found the prison to have been located. I mean, which is kind of interesting that they were actually in charge of the level of secrecy the members were allowed to have dealing with their own operation or dealing with an operation that happened in their own site. I've spoken to a number of the MPs that were involved in that, and basically their investigation was sending letters to different Romanian government institutions asking, do you know anything about a secret prison in Romania? And they all kind of answered no, and then the investigation was dropped. Now, with new evidence, you know, there may be a new investigation.
Do you have any sense of where your work's going to go in the future? What kind of areas people might want to continue to look at? Where the pressure ought to go on this?
What I think is interesting about the case is that many people think, oh, you know, the secret prison story is over. And the facts are that outside of flight logs and maybe now some locations of the prisons, no one really knows anything about what happened inside these places. I mean, there's some details about what happened. No one knows how they were run. No one knows, you know, who exactly ran them. No one knows perimeter security, you know, how food was brought in. I mean, remains a real black box in American history.
John Goetz, thank you very much, particularly for this last discovery, Secret Prison in Bucharest, Romania.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, John.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
This year marks the 70th anniversary of the first Smith Act indictment in 1941 of revolutionaries in Minneapolis, Minnesota, accused of conspiring to overthrow the government at some future date by force and violence. The law was intended to destroy the 100,000-strong member American Communist Party. However, the Smith Act was first used, before it was used against the Communist Party, against the much smaller revolutionary rival of the Communist Party, the Socialist Workers' Party. Our returning guest, author and activist Joe Allen, writes about the 70th anniversary. The Alien Registration Act of 1940, also known as the Smith Act, after its sponsor, Representative Howard K. Smith of Virginia, a Democrat, segregationist, and the leader of the anti-labor bloc in the House of Representatives, the Smith Act became the legal weapon which the government used successfully for 25 years to cripple the left, from the 1940s all the way up into the beginning of the 1960s. The Act reads as follows: whoever organizes or helps or attempts to organize any society, group, or assembly of persons who teach, advocate, or encourage the overthrow of the destruction of any such government by force or violence, or becomes or is a member of or affiliates with any such society, group, or assembly of persons, knowing the purpose thereof, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both, and shall be ineligible for employment by the United States or any department or agency thereof for the 5 years next following his conviction. We talk more about the Smith Act, which is still on the books, with Joe Allen, and also about the long history of legal battles in the United States labor and socialist movements against the Smith Act. Joe Allen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Joe, this is the 70th anniversary of the first use, the indictment of revolutionaries in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1941 under the Smith Act, the first use of the Smith Act, the Alien and Registration Act. What do you think the significance of the use of the Smith Act was then and now?
Well, the way I would start looking at it, Michael, is in two ways. One is that for many people in the United States, the defense of civil liberties has always been an important and constant feature of our history. And during most of that time, the defense of civil liberties has not been primarily against vigilantes or rogue elements of the government or corrupt public officials. While that's certainly an important part of that, it has always been dealing with the actual laws that have attempted to undermine civil liberties. Most of the time, they have been federal laws. So you can go back to the Alien and Sedition Act under the Adams administration, the Espionage Act during World War I, and all of these were used primarily against opponents of the government. They were never used against, say, spies, as they were sold to people.
Well, let's talk about the use of the Smith Act.
Right.
The indictments came down in 1941. The trial was in 43. The revolutionaries were sent to prison. Who was it that was indicted in 41, and why were they indicted?
Well, in 1941, the Smith Act was used to indicted the leadership primarily of the members of the Socialist Workers' Party, and particularly those who had been leaders of the local Teamsters Union, Local 544. They had been the leaders, particularly the Dunn brothers and Carl Skoglund and Farrell Dobbs, who were the leading figures. There were many others involved.
They were the leaders of the three general strikes in 1934 in Minneapolis, weren't they?
Yes, they were. And, of course, you know, that those struggles not only were known quite widely around the United States at the time, but they were one of the contributing factors to creating the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the big militant union that came to represent the aspirations of many American workers in the 1930s. And in many ways, it really led to the birth of the modern Teamsters Union at that time.
Yeah, it went from a bunch of conservative old horse and buggy drivers into truck drivers that drove rigs cross-country. It was Farrell Dobbs that organized the Teamsters in 11 Midwestern states across the country. And he was the one of the people that was put in prison in 43 after he was convicted under the Smith Act. But let's talk about the various people that went to prison and what their histories were. Who was Jim Cannon?
Well, James Cannon was one of the most important figures in American socialist history. His life really kind of transversed the history of the American far left in the 20th century. He began his political life in the industrial workers of the world, you know, popularly known as the Wobblies, the radical militant trade union that organized really the, you know, the most oppressed sectors of American workers in the 19-teens. He was a founding member and then later national chair of the American Communist Party.
In 1919
and later became the chair of the party in 1923. One of his major concerns and contributions to the American socialist movement and to civil liberties is that, he, like many Wobblies and early members of the Communist Party, he was very concerned with the civil liberties of radicals and trade union organizers, and was the head of an organization called the International Labor Defense in the 1920s, which was a nonpartisan, very broad initiative of the American Communist Party to represent radical militant workers, victims of political persecution all across the country. It may have been the best thing ever organized by the old left in this country.
And I thoroughly agree with you. And, you know, the National Lawyers Guild, which I belong to, has its origins in the International Labor Defense. So the mass defense you see of the Occupied Wall Street movement today has its roots that go all the way back to the IWW. An injury to one is an injury to all, and kind of a nonpartisan defense. Didn't matter what political tendency you were in. There was a sense of solidarity there, and that was the principle on which the ILD was organized and on which the National Lawyers Guild is organized.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, that was one of the contributing factors to Cannon developing a criticism of and his dissent within the American Communist Party as the ILD became moved away from its original mission, and Cannon himself began along with a number of other significant figures in the American Communist Party, notably Max Shackman and Martin Abern, and other people who sided with Trotsky in the dispute with Stalin about the direction of not only the Soviet Union, but also the international communist movement. He was the founder of American Trotskyism in the late 20s and early 1930s. It was really his training of a whole generation of people who left the CP in founding the Trotskyist movement, who not only led the Minneapolis strikes in 1934, but that broad layer of people, ultimately 28 of them, who were indicted under the Smith Act in 1941, primarily for, quote, advocating the overthrow of the United States government.
Well, others that were indicted, Carl Skoglund had been in the IWW, a immigrant from Sweden, like Joe Hill. Ray Dunn, leader of the Teamster movement there, also had been in the IWW, a friend of Cannon since they were both young men. Grace Carlson had run for Senate in Minnesota. They indicted these militant labor leaders who were also left-wing socialists. Tell us about the conservative president of the Teamsters Union, James Tobin, and what role he had in securing the indictment.
Well, it was Dan Tobin, and Dan Tobin was, had been a leader of the union for many years. And he was an old-style AFL trade union official. He did not want the union to represent what he called unskilled workers and fought tooth and nail the organizing efforts of the socialists in Minneapolis in 1934 to organize a broad union. And for many years afterwards, while he had to sort of accommodate the growth of the union based on the sort of strategy and tactics of the Minneapolis socialists, he also was waiting and biding his time to get rid of them. And after the passage of the Smith Act in 1940, he saw an opportunity to appeal to his friends in the White House, particularly Franklin Roosevelt, to use the law to rid him of these radicals in his union. And so during the course of 1941, when it was becoming clear that not only was the Teamsters heading in a direction that the Minneapolis socialists didn't want to it to go in, but they were finding also that they couldn't really exist inside of it anymore, they put the membership of whether they would continue in the Teamsters or to join the CIO up for a membership vote in the local union, and the local union overwhelmingly voted to leave the Teamsters and to join the CIO. It was at that point that Dan Tobin made a direct political appeal to Franklin Roosevelt to go after these people, and Roosevelt contacted his attorney general, Francis Biddle, who had been a consulting attorney to the American Civil Liberties Union.
I knew that, yeah.
To go after the Minneapolis Trotskyists, and on June 27th, 1941, the FBI and U.S. Marshals raided their offices in Minneapolis-St. Paul, seizing hundreds of documents, mostly newspapers, books, and pamphlets, and several weeks later indicted them for violating the Smith Act.
Well, could you characterize this indictment under the Smith Act, which was for a conspiracy to advocate force and violence and the overthrow of the government, could you characterize this as a thought crime?
Well, I think it's certainly a thought crime. It's also, in a sense, a response to a dispute inside the labor movement. As the U.S. was preparing for World War II, many sections of the labor leadership wanted to accommodate themselves to the Roosevelt administration, and others did not, and that primarily revolved around the right to strike, the right to advocate your own political ideas, to keep an independence from the Democratic Party, things that have been reoccurring issues ever since then. And the Roosevelt administration, despite the fact that it was in its Justice Department and in the Supreme Court through Roosevelt's appointees, was dominated by liberals who had gone through World War I, and many of whom vowed that they would never repeat the mistakes of World War I, which, as they saw, was a widespread attack on political dissent and civil liberties, actually launched this attack on the Minneapolis socialists using many of the same rationales that were used two decades earlier.
The Minneapolis defendants did not advocate violence. They said they were for self-defense, but they did not advocate violence. None of the books that were used against them, principally Marx's Communist Manifesto or Lenin's State and Revolution, advocate violence. So how were they able to get a conviction?
Well, I think they did a number of things. I mean, one of the things that they did, like as most experienced trial lawyers know, is that the first thing that a prosecutor tries to do is they try to get a jury that will be predisposed to the prosecution and not the defense. And so even though Minnesota had a very radical tradition among its working class, it also had a very radical tradition among its rural population. They picked a jury where they found nobody lived in a city, nobody was a trade unionist. So they had a very sort of conservative, lower middle class composition to it. They used a lot of FBI agents, testified about the literature that they had found. And they also used the testimony of turncoats, particularly a man named James Bartlett, who had been a member of the party. And what they did is they used quotes out of context, they used perjured testimony, and they used a kind of predisposition against radicalism that existed at the time, at least among a section of the population, to secure a victory, a guilty verdict. But it also should be mentioned that the government didn't get everything that they wanted. The government went after them on two counts. One was for violating an 1861 sedition law that was directed against the Southern slave owners for organizing armed rebellion. They didn't get that. They essentially indicted them for, convicted them on the part of the Smith Act about advocating ideas. And in that sense, they were probably guilty. That's one of the great travesties of the Smith Act, is that you can be indicted and convicted not for the things that you do, but the things that you say. And in that sense, it really is a thought control crime.
I've read the testimony of James P. Cannon, who was the lead defendant, mm-hmm. In a book called Socialism on Trial.
Great document.
It's a great book. Everybody should still read that book because of the formulations, because Cannon says, we are not for violence, we're for self-defense. And in the course of great social struggles, the bad guys, the 1% against the 99%, the bad guys inevitably use violence against the majority. And in a situation like that, we're for defending ourselves. And he stood on that principle, and I guess that's what was so unavailing, and they got the conviction. Cannon and the others went to prison for 12 to 18 months. One of the lawyers for the defendants, Albert Goldman, also went to prison. He was one of the defendants as well as the lawyer. Tell us that story.
Well, Albert Goldman is tragically one of the most forgotten figures in American radical and socialist history. I mean, it's not only very rare that the lead counsel in a case is also a defendant. I mean, that's so rare that I can't even really think of another case.
Fidel Castro summation was printed up in the form of a book that's also worth reading, just like Fidel Castro's History Will Absolve Me defense is worth reading. I think he was one of the great Midwest radical lawyers right up there with Clarence Darrow and Ernie Goodman.
Well, absolutely. And, of course, you know, his most famous defendant was Leon Trotsky. Goldman represented Trotsky before the Dewey Commissions in Mexico that were challenging the charges made against Trotsky at the infamous Moscow trials held in Russia, which destroyed the last of the revolutionary leaders of the Russian Revolution. Trotsky was accused of being an agent of Hitler and other such ridiculous charges, which only furthered the repression inside of Russia. And Goldman was his personal attorney during those hearings. Goldman was a pretty amazing figure in a lot of ways. He represented clients high and low, really spent a good part of his time as a lawyer, not living off of very much money, but completely dedicated to fighting for a better society. And in some ways, among the defendants of the Minneapolis case, he paid the highest price.
He
was later disbarred by the Illinois bar, and it really drove him into poverty.
He wound up driving a cab. I remember his papers were given to the University of Wisconsin Historical Society, and I knew people that had read them, principally Pat Quinn, who you collaborated with,
mm-hmm.
and it's really a terrible loss what they did to that attorney. Let's switch gears now, Joe, because mm-hmm. the Smith Act trial of 1943, where the revolutionary left of the Teamsters Union and the Socialist Workers Party were imprisoned before the war, there was another trial in 1949, and this time it was against the Communist Party. It took place here in Foley Square in New York City,
and the leadership of the Communist Party were indicted for the same reasons, conspiring to sometime in the future overthrow the American government by force and violence. This was an extremely important event in the history of the American left because it put a crippling blow on the left that I would say lasted a couple of decades. Talk to us about the use of the Smith Act against the leadership of the Communist Party in 49.
Well, it's one of those examples of how if you don't fight something at the beginning of an era, it can come back to haunt you. And, of course, in 1941, instead of the Communist Party rallying to defense of the Minneapolis Trotskyists during the first Smith Act trial, they actually cheered on the prosecution.
They said it was constitutional.
They said it was not only constitutional, but they equated Trotskyists with being fascists. And this is something that Paul Robeson, much later, even defended after the conviction of the Minneapolis socialists and the leaders of the Communist Party themselves were under indictment. It's one of the great tragedies of American socialist history. I mean, after the war, you had an intense heated up rivalry between Russia and the United States for global domination and influence. And at home, this meant there was an intense period of repression against the left, whatever political stripe you might have. Have been. And in 1948, under Harry Truman, who's sometimes still referred to as the man of the people, or the president of the common man, for reasons I've never understood, his attorney general indicted the leadership of the American Communist Party, and they went to trial. It was an enormously long and contentious trial. It lasted
9 months.
9 months, and though the verdict came down only in a matter of hours afterwards, it not only convicted them, but unlike the first Smith Act trial, where the Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal of the Minneapolis Trotskyists, the Supreme Court later did hear the appeal of the American Communist Party leaders and upheld the Smith Act as the law of the land. Many of the leaders of the party went to prison for years. Many of them, including Henry Winston, I think, it contributed to a significant decline in his health. But
well, they wouldn't provide Winston with medical care, and as a consequence, he went blind. He was in prison for 5 years, as were most of the defendants.
Mm-hmm. The other outcome, the most important outcome of the Smith Act, their trial, the Communist Party's Smith Act trial, is that it effectively destroyed the left in this country during the late 40s and the early 1950s.
I grew up in that period, and I remember the stigma on the Communist Party is being faintly subversive because they criminalized him. The membership of the Communist Party after the convictions didn't go down, but no one else joined. And
right.
the groups that they worked with all faded away, and the left went into a general decline. I wanted to just mention that Henry Winston was one of the black leaders of the Communist Party, and I think there was a real element of racism in the prosecution. Another person...
And anti-Semitism.
And of course, anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. It was like a show trial in Foley Square. They had 400 cops. The atmosphere was one of utter fear. It reminded me of the Lynn Stewart trial when you had all these cops around, and the jury couldn't help but think that somehow Lynn Stewart was a dangerous character. A friend of mine's husband was sent to prison, Bob Thompson, who had won the Distinguished Service Cross for fighting in the Second World War, and the government showed their appreciation of Thompson's service by sentencing him only to 3 years. When he was in prison, a Yugoslav fascist bashed in his head with a lead pipe, causing brain damage. He died shortly after getting out of prison, wanted to be buried in Arlington Cemetery as a war hero, and the government refused to bury him in Arlington. And there was a big legal fight, and finally he won and was buried in Arlington. And then there was another trial which extended that atmosphere, the secondary leadership mm-hmm. of the Communist Party. Hoover went to Truman and said, "You haven't done enough. You're really right. Not sincere." 23 secondary leaders of the Communist Party, including Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who mm-hmm. had been a leader of the American Civil Liberties Union, had been in the IWW, was the most famous woman radical in the country. She was indicted with the 23, and they were all sent to prison. And all in all, I think it was about 140 different Communist Party activists, the first and secondary leadership, were all imprisoned. The use of the Smith Act was available to the government, still exists on the books, but
By 1957, there were a couple of Supreme Court cases, the Yates case and the Watkins case, that defined intent differently. So they said, well, you can be a member of the Communist Party, but being a member doesn't in and of itself show that you're for the violent overthrow of the government, and therefore they stopped indicting people. But the damage had been done.
Well, yeah, I actually think Junius Scales was the last person to go to prison for being a member of the Communist Party, even though he had actually left the CP years earlier in 1960. The deep breach of the Smith Act, because you had the federal prosecutions, but that then gave the go-ahead for the states to launch their own various prosecutions of
exactly.
the left. And so it was a pretty horrendous period, and I think it goes to show that, you know, there's a long history of particularly federal legal persecution of radicals and dissidents in this country that goes back to, you know, to almost the very founding of the country and continues through this very day with the Patriot Act and the various versions of that on the state level across the country. And, you know, the Smith Act, you know, whether the trials, whether they be of the Minneapolis Socialists or the Communist Party later, shouldn't be seen as sort of museum pieces of history, but part of American legal and political history, but also part of the resistance to the attacks on civil liberties. Scott Martel's new book, published this year, is about the Communist Party Smith Act trial. It's called Democracy on Trial, and I would encourage everyone to read it if you can.
Joe Allen, it's a pleasure again to have you on Law and Disorder. You're working on a book called Free Speech on Trial, and when you get it done, you'll come back and talk to us. You do wonderful work out there in Chicago, and we really appreciate having you here on the show. Thank you so much, Joe Allen.
Thank you, Michael.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.